This is Paul Morledge of the UW Oral History Project. Today is May 22nd, 1998, and I'm interviewing Professor Richard Heine in the Material Sciences and Engineering Building. We're going to begin today, session two, talking about biblical references regarding the importance of casting and recycling to mankind. Professor Heine has some comments he'd like to make on some of these religious connections to his engineering work.
Excuse me. These comments relate to the molding materials, and specifically molding sand, that was being used at the time that I entered technical work in this field, in comparison with those that were used in biblical times at the time of the building of the tabernacle under Moses' instructions and the building of Solomon's temple later. In particular, with reference to the building of Solomon's temple, the castings were made in molds that were built in the of molding sand in the plain of the clay ground of the plain of Jordan near certain towns. Now, this is a very interesting revelation of the kind of molding material that was used for making sand casting at that time, which was roughly 1000 BC. Because it's interesting, because when I entered the foundry technology field, these sands were still being used for the most part in most casting operations. This kind of a sand is known as natural molding sand, meaning that it exists naturally in the ground and can be mined and upgraded somewhat, cleaned of debris, and used directly for making molds that subsequently are used for producing the castings. So here from 1000 BC until about 1940 AD, we have essentially the same kind of mold material being used for making sand molds for casting purposes. And my work spans the time after that, of course. When I came to the University of Wisconsin, the casting laboratory had in it only naturally bonded molding sands. At the same time, naturally bonded molding sands were being used in foundries around the state, in particular the Kohler Company foundry for their enamelware tubs and sinks and so forth were made in naturally bonded molding sands. Subsequent to that time, which follows World War II and proceeds until the present, introduction of synthetic molding sands occurred and has been continually refined and changed as the automated machinery has improved over that time period. These synthetic sands are comprised of clays of a specific kind that are mined, and sand that is mined. Again, these sands are mined locally in Wisconsin around the Berlin, Princeton area, and in other places, Portage, but the clay is mined out west in Montana, Wyoming, South Dakota, and so forth. These are combined with other materials to produce what's called a synthetic molding sand. And these are the sands that I have worked in since about 1948, and have published a great deal of information in connection with their use and improvement. So you see this is a naturally a great interest to me to be involved in the historical change that has taken place in such a short period of time compared to what occurred prior to that time, going back to the biblically produced castings. In connection with the biblical description of castings, Moses was told to build a tabernacle by the Lord, and this means that you have to find someone to do the job. And in several different places, these two men are specifically identified as being able to do this and also to teach others how to do this. I'd like to refer to the book of Exodus, chapter 31, verses 1 through 5, and reading, 35 verses 1 through 31, specifically referring to verse 31, verse 30. Moses says, "See, the Lord called by name Bezalel." Incidentally, we have a department member whose first name is Bezalel. "The son of Uri, son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah. And he has filled him with the Spirit of God, with ability and wisdom, with intelligence and understanding, and with knowledge and all craftsmanship, to devise artistic designs to work in gold, silver, and bronze. And God has put in Bezalel's heart that he may teach, both he and Oholiab, son of Ahizamak of the tribe of Dan. He has filled them with wisdom of heart and ability to do all manner of craftsmanship," and so forth and so on. Note that combined here is craftsmanship and teaching. And this is, I think, the way that technology develops. That's around 1500 BC. David, Solomon's father, wanted to build a temple and was so instructed. But he was not allowed to. But he was told that his son Solomon would build that temple. And this is in the period of around 1000 BC, where it is stated that the bronze castings, the bronze cast altar that Bezalel made was still available and was used in the tabernacle and would be transferred to the temple. One might ask, where did the metal come from? And this is described in Deuteronomy 8, verse 9, where Moses is communicating God's instructions of how the Israelites are to live and what good will befall them, and if they don't live that way, what evil will befall them. In chapter 8, verse 9, Deuteronomy, the source of the metals is revealed as part of the gift of the promised land. The Lord is saying, he's talking about the land that they will occupy and inherit. Deuteronomy 8, verse 9, a land of wheat and barley, vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive trees and honey, a land in which you shall eat food without shortage and lack nothing in it, a land whose stones are iron and out of whose hills you can dig copper. How about that? Yeah. The supply is available to make the castings, the bronze castings and the iron utensils. So anyway, the skill and the materials are available here at this time, about 1500 BC. It's still exactly the same situation which we have today. We have to have craftsmen that can do the job, and we have to have materials that are usable. It doesn't matter whether they're metals, ceramics, or polymers or what have you, that combination still has to go. And the skill and technology has to be transferable, which means that it needs to be taught and improved. Okay, so much for that. When Solomon began to build the temple, he had to find a skilled man. Hiram of Tyre was the man who was called. And he had the ability to make these tremendous castings that were described as made for Solomon's temple. In the first book of Kings, some of these castings are described, and they are awesome in size. First Kings 13:51. You had to have a man to do the job. In chapter 7 of First Kings, verse 13, says King Solomon brought Hiram from Tyre. He was the son of a widow of the tribe of Naphtali, which is where his origins were. And his father was a worker in bronze. Hiram was full of wisdom, understanding, and skill, meaning craftsmanship, to do any kind of work in bronze. So he came to King Solomon and did all his bronze work. He fashioned the two pillars of bronze, each 18 cubits high, and a line of 12 cubits measured its circumference. Well, if you figure that out on the basis of about a foot and a half to a cubit, why, it turns out that columns were about 27 feet high and about 4 feet in diameter and about 4 inches thick. This is a tremendous large casting, so it had to be made in a pit dug in the ground so that the mold could be built up from the ground below, and the molten metal would be constrained by the surrounding ground. Well, this is a practice that is still followed today in the making of very large castings. For example, in making castings for turbine runners and so forth for the Aswan Dam in Egypt, pit molds were made to produce these large castings, which may weigh hundreds of tons. They have to be very strong molds, and that's the way they were made then, and they are still made that way, although our supporting framework may be different. So anyway, there's a great deal of description of the various castings and the interior fittings of the temple, which are quite amazing. And it says in scripture that the amount of bronze castings was so great that they didn't count the weight. Finally, it describes in verse 46 that in the Jordan plain, the king cast them in a clay ground between Succoth and Zarethan. Well, the king didn't cast them, Hiram did, but that's still the way it is today. The boss who says this is what needs to be done gets the credit. The guy who does it doesn't get the credit. That's the boss versus the worker deal. So some things really don't change very much. We're a little bit better at giving credit today, I think, maybe. Anyway, again, the description that these castings were made in the clay ground of the plain of Jordan tells us that this was a natural molding sand of the proper mixture of clay and silica sand so that you could make molds with the clay and sand mixture wet for plasticity. You could dry it so it would develop great strength and withstand the tremendous weight that these castings would produce. As I had previously mentioned, those processes were used for the making of castings everywhere in the world where castings were made with natural molding sand up until the advent of the synthetic sands, which took place very slowly over the period from middle 30s, early 40s, through our present day today. Today we have many other kinds of molding materials involving polymers that are used for binding sands, but the clay-bonded sand still is used for the probably 80% of the weight of castings being produced. So that's the period that I have been living through and working on the technology of molding sands since I came here in 1947. That, I think, is pretty much what I want to say about this. Castings were a very important part of our American heritage.
Okay. I may appear somewhat as a non sequitur, but where have you obtained funding for your research, and how, if at all, has research funding changed over your career?
Well, I have obtained funding from various sources. American Foundryman Society, Technical Society of the Industry, supports research, and I've had some of that money. The various foundry companies have sponsored a good deal of my research. I obtained some funding from government sources, in particular the Bureau of Mines, in which recycling was being investigated. That reminds me, recycling goes back to those biblical times too, because every time a given country invaded another country and defeated them, they confiscated their metal objects, broke them up, took them back to their own country, and recast them into whatever they wanted. That's also documented in the scripture.
Yeah.
So there's nothing new about recycling.
Yeah.
Today, probably 95% of castings are recycled and have been used many times before. At any rate, I forgot where I am. Where am I?
You mentioned where you've been getting your research now.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Do you want to comment on how this research funding's changed over the years?
Well, now most of the research funding that comes in my own field, most of the research funding still comes from industry technical societies. However, there is an increasing participation on the part of the Department of Energy. The casting industry is a energy-consuming industry and needs to be recognized as such, so that you can have the energy necessary to operate electric furnaces or fuel-fired furnaces, gas-fired furnaces, and so forth. So the Department of Energy is now providing funding. In my time of that was not the case. The National Science Foundation has provided substantial funding in the material science area. this is of greater interest to the material science people in our department, although not many of them have done anything in the casting field. The funding that's available is generally aimed at more scientific activities than what the foundry industry is regarded as needing, although that's not really the case.
Okay.
I think that's probably about where it is. At the present time, I still have some industry funding to support my retirement research activities. I do have a grant from the Wisconsin Recycling Board to investigate the recovery of clay and other additives from spent molding sands. This is the second year of that project, and in this case, what I'm doing is reversing what I got initially involved in, and that's putting together a synthetic sand for molding purposes, and now I'm working on taking it apart so you can reuse what's in it. Kind of ironic, but that's the way it is.
Did you have any more to comment on that, or?
Well, no, except that there are a couple of ways of potential ways of recovering the values in the sand. in addition to beneficial reuse, a good deal of beneficial reuse is underway for building berms, for covering ground cover for municipal waste disposal sites, road construction, and so forth and so on.
Okay. Professor Heine, discuss if you would the research climate in the College of Engineering here and in the UW-Madison campus in general, and how, if at all, these climates have changed over the years.
Well, the big change, on discussing that first, is that the government has become very active in funding research, but particularly through the National Science Foundation, which has not had much of an interest in the technology related to castings production, although it should. So that that source of government funding has been relatively minor as far as the casting process is concerned. Some activities have been funded in terms of the effect of carrying on these operations in space, solidification of metals in space, for example, where gravity effects are not prominent as they are here. Some of that kind of work has been done. I've been involved in a little bit of that, brazing components, tubular components in space. I was involved in a program on that, but these are have not really been very useful to the castings industry in technological terms, although I've had some of that funding. But that's the direction where the kind of money that the university and the colleges are seeking comes from, the larger grants, in other words. There's still funding of the kind that I mentioned, that is the technical societies and the companies available, but it's small in comparison to government funding, so that it doesn't suit the needs of faculty who are striving desperately to attain tenure, which I think is quite an unfortunate situation.
Okay. In the early 1960s, Heine, Loper, and Rosenthal wrote, quote, Principles of Metal Castings.
Well, the first edition of that book was written by Heine and Rosenthal.
Oh, okay.
And published in the middle 50s. Professor Loper was a graduate student of mine, PhD, who has become a worldwide authority in the casting field, known everywhere and called to many foreign countries, joined our work on that textbook in the revision of 1965. It has not had been revised since then, and is substantially out of date in terms of the technology described, but not really out of date in terms of the principles involved. There was no textbook at that time that could be used at the level we desire to teach at, and so we had to write something. At this time, there are other textbooks that can be used, although there's no real substitute for the one that we wrote, and the energy required to do that again is too great for us.
Okay. Are there any other items from your publishing record you think deserve special mention?
Well, I'm quite sure the only publisher in the Transactions of the American Foundryman Society that has received Best Paper of the Year awards from four different divisions of the society. By divisions, this refers to the major interest of that particular group, namely molding sands, cast irons, malleable iron, gray iron, engineering.
Okay.
I also am the only, I am one of two individuals who have received three awards for the Technical Paper of the Year, which has had a profound influence on the on foundry technologies.
Okay. Did you want to discuss any more on that, or?
No, not particularly.
Okay.
I'm the only faculty member that has had that honor.
Okay.
The other person is an industry research person.
And Professor Heine, how, if at all, did some of the significant historical events of this century, such as World War II, the Cold War, the Space Race, and the Vietnam War, affect both the funding and direction of your research?
Well, I have already mentioned the fact that the transition from naturally bonded molding sands to synthetic sands was accelerated by World War II, actually, and took place pretty much after the war was over, but began in that period. So that was quite an event as far as my own research efforts were concerned. Regarding each of these war incidents, each one of them placed great demands on armament materiel. I might mention as a historical note that at the time of the Revolution, the only source of materiel for war in our colonial country was the foundry industry that existed at that time, in other words, during the middle 1700s. And that's true of every war. You cannot fight a war without a castings industry. And because it provides the material necessary to carry on the war, regardless of whether you're talking about transportation vehicles or tanks or whatever, armament and so forth and so on. That's inherent in the nature of the war, armament requirements. So each one of these provided a significant force on improving foundry technology so that the quality of castings increased greatly. And as a consequence, more and more castings are being used for aircraft, space vehicles, and so forth, where castings would not ordinarily have been used. Things have not greatly affected the source of my fundings because I have not been primarily related in terms of research to those conflicts.
And
it hasn't changed the direction of my research.
Okay, and the space race too had a major impact?
Well, I had a grant for studying the effects of space environment on brazing, which is not exactly a casting process, but it involves melting and solidification. So in that sense, it is.
Zero gravity effects on that, you mean?
Well, zero gravity, yeah. And different atmosphere and so forth.
You've been granted some patents during your engineering career. What were these patents for?
Well, I'd rather not comment on that.
Okay, would you care to comment on whether you collaborated with Worf or not?
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
They were not of sufficient significance to be meaningful.
Okay.
I had a computer program that was a source of some income for Worf.
Okay. Now I'd like to touch on some of your teaching during your career? You don't have to list them all, but in general, what courses do you teach most frequently in the College of Engineering?
Well, all of the courses that were related to solidification of metals and casting process. Those were all generated by my colleagues and me, namely Rosenthal, Loper, and myself.
Okay, did you create any courses?
The courses that were taught were created by us.
Oh, okay, but you individually didn't.
But if you give a course that's never been given before, isn't that creating it?
Well, no, I wonder if just you personally created a course aside from Rosenthal and Loper.
Well, first of all, we had to have a textbook.
Okay.
Before the textbook was written, the course was given, and the textbook sprung out of the course.
Oh, okay, so just from lecture notes and things?
Yeah.
Okay. Again, in your opinion, has the quality of engineering student changed with the times? And if so, in what ways?
Well, the first obvious change is that we have much greater diversity in our student body. When I came here, women were quite scarce. We did happen to have one undergraduate student in our program at that time. She did graduate. We've had occasionally, from time to time, some women that went into the foundry field, the casting field, but only in the last, since about 1980 has the number significantly increased. We do have a number of women that are active in the technologically active in the castings fields as graduates of our department who took our courses. Quality of students. They are, there is a greater percentage of students who do not have an engineering type background. What I mean by that can be best illustrated by the background of the students that were here when I came. First of all, in the beginning, they were veterans of World War II. Then we had a large number of students who had come to us from farms. They knew machinery, and they knew what tools were, hand tools and other tools. So that they had a hands-on feel for engineering types of activity related more to mechanical engineering than to metallurgical engineering, but that background was invaluable in providing them with the concept of the things that have to be made in order for the farm equipment to exist. So that was a great benefit. That percentage of students that came from the farm background or from parents, in particular fathers or uncles, who were involved in manufacturing activities in the industries of Wisconsin, all of those types of students had a much more direct contact with what was then called metallurgical engineering and where the casting field was. The percentage of students that had that background has substantially declined as time has gone on. They have been students that have been much more academically oriented. and I don't regard that as a favorable change. However, we still have a number that do have that, what you might call a practical background, and unfortunately for them, they are not happy with the emphasis on materials science rather than materials engineering, which has been taking place in our department over the last 15 years. 15 years, yeah.
Okay.
They would much more prefer a materials engineering approach, but their voices are not being heard. Our materials science faculty ignores their desires for those kinds of courses.
Would you like to comment on why you think that is, or?
Well, they are interested in carrying on their own research because of the requirement to raise money from funding sources for the university, what do they call that kind of money? Money that goes to the university for administrative purposes. They are much more interested in teaching those things that will prepare students for carrying on their research. That's not unusual, but that research is usually more scientifically oriented than it is engineering oriented. And so the undergraduate courses then reflect that change, you see.
Okay.
Administrative overhead.
And you touched on it a little bit. Have you noticed significant changes in student demographics over the years in the College of Engineering? For example, more minority students?
Well, I've mentioned that.
Students.
We do have more foreign students, but we've always had quite a number of foreign students in our department.
How about minorities and women?
That has been increasing progressively, as I mentioned before.
Okay.
And some of them are well prepared and some are not.
Okay.
I don't see that they're any more, that they are superior to the students we get from our American school system.
Okay. And were there any courses you team taught or that are interdisciplinary in nature?
Well, yes. These were courses several different manufacturing processes were being taught. For example, welding and casting, forging, and so on. The casting field would be particularly taught by me or Rosenthal, Wilburn, and so forth.
And yet other experts come in to teach the other facets, or?
No, not really.
Oh, okay.
Where would you get them from?
I don't know. And do any of your former students come to mind for their engineering aptitude and resultant career success?
Oh, there's a whole mess of them.
No one in particular stands out in your mind?
Well, there are certain individuals that stand out because of the way that they have conducted their careers after leaving here. My expectation would be that an engineering employee in a particular field first demonstrates his technical competence and his skills of getting along with people. If he is found to be really competent in those areas, it doesn't take very long and he begins to move into management type activities. Because that's the only way that a company can multiply his particular skills. And so I've seen that happen with a number of the students that I have personally followed. And incidentally, I do consulting work for them. They invite me to come in. And what do I do when I get there? All I do is teach more engineering. They accuse me of not teaching them everything that I knew when they were here. So they have to call me in to consult. And I tell them that I did, but they weren't listening. Not only that, but I learned a lot since they left. Which makes it fun.
Okay, now we're just going to touch on your service here.
I've already covered some of that.
Right. You've received a number of awards and honors over your career. Would you like to give any special mention?
Well, the school where I got my undergraduate degree honored me as a distinguished alumnus quite some time ago.
Wayne State?
Yeah.
You're in their Hall of Fame?
Well, I don't know what they call it.
Oh, okay.
I was especially happy to receive the Ragnar Onstad Award for service to science and society.
Would you care to mention what you did?
Well, that's a nomination by your peers. I don't know what they nominated me for.
Church worker.
I was very active in the YMCA.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I remember you.
And my church activities.
Okay. And you've been a member of numerous professional organizations. Would you care to give any such memberships special mention?
Well, I've been a member of the American Foundryman Society, and I've been an officer of our Wisconsin chapter, board of directors, and so forth and so on. I am happy with that because I learned to know many of the leaders of our industry here, both administrative and technical. So I've enjoyed that. And, there's one thing I have forgotten all the way through here. There's an Earth Foundation, which was established about 1946 or 7. They chose their purpose, reason for existence, is to encourage technical education at the college or university level in the casting processes, and the employment of graduates in the castings industry. That was a moving force behind my being brought here from General Motors Institute, so that I owe that connection to Professor George Barker, who was our department chairman at the time. The Foundry Educational Foundation has contributed very substantially to funds to our department and to other schools. The University of Wisconsin was chosen as a part of this initial group, which included Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Cornell University, Ohio State University, University of Cincinnati. I'm trying to remember who else. University of Michigan.
Okay.
I'm not sure about the last one, but I know those first five are correct. Oh, Case Western Reserve. Case School of Applied Science, it was at that time, Case Western Reserve University. The University of Michigan. Okay. Now that foundation has contributed money every year and scholarships every year to our department as a sign of their interest in helping students get through meeting financial obligations and so forth and so on. That organization has grown, has added a number of other schools. The University of Wisconsin is still the most prominent. Oh, the University of Alabama was another one of those chosen to be among this group. At any rate, the Foundry Educational Foundation has been a very vital force in promoting education in the casting process. And to this day, there is no other manufacturing process that has the impact on the education activities and interests of students than has been made by the Foundry Educational Foundation. I think this is a typical example of the foresight of the leaders of this industry, of which we have a number of in the state of Wisconsin. I was the so-called Foundry Educational Foundation professor at the University of Wisconsin for a long time until I became the department chairman. Then Professor Loper became that and remains that to this day. In other words, the Foundry Educational Foundation has a, what you might call a faculty professorial contact at each of these institutions.
Okay, now I'd like to cover the Department of Materials Science and Engineering and the College of Engineering in general. Could you briefly discuss the evolution of the Department of Materials Science and Engineering from its earliest days as originally the Department of Mining?
Well, when I came in 1947, the department name was Department of Mining and Metallurgy, and the mining program was still quite active. That was probably a consequence of the mining activities that were still going on in the Platteville area.
Okay.
As the that mining activity diminished, the enrollment in that area declined, but we still continued certain of the courses. Professor Rosenthal caused the department name to change to Department of Minerals and Metals Engineering, which was pretty descriptive at that time. And the emphasis on metallurgical engineering and manufacturing processing as it involves metallurgical engineering was increased in emphasis. Professor Rosenthal was a great teacher, by the way, a mentor of mine.
Okay.
Subsequent to Professor Rosenthal, I became the department chairman. I was able to bridge the gap between strictly metallurgical engineering and material science. I caused certain of our basic metallurgy courses to be redesignated in the curriculum as material science courses. That was an action that I took because I felt that that would be a growing emphasis in the metallurgical field, which it has been.
Did you do that based on some other universities doing that, or is this more your own insight?
Well, it was a trend that was taking place. Some schools, they wiped out the metallurgical engineering connection and became departments of material science. At other schools, the metallurgical engineering activity was continued because metallurgical engineering as it was taught at that time involved considerations of reactions of solids, liquids, and gases in manufacturing processes, whereas material science, as it was considered, as it was taught at that time, was much more related to the physics of metals, and still is. And that makes a distinction that's important because the engineering and the manufacturing processing activities are complex systems that are not readily amenable to simple component, single component, or limited multi-component systems. Most metallurgical systems, metallurgical manufacturing systems, are multi-component systems that are very difficult to characterize. Of course, the computer's capabilities have improved that, but the systems are of such a complex nature that ordinarily science-oriented people don't like to deal with them. At any rate, that transition took place gradually, and material science has substantially, you might say, dominated the instructional coursework and the staff, so that we are quite limited in our staff capabilities for teaching manufacturing, engineering, metallurgy.
Okay.
During my tenureship, I had the department's name changed to did I say this already?
To material science and engineering?
No, that change took place subsequently.
See, metallurgical and mineral engineering?
Yeah, metallurgical and mineral engineering, yeah. Let me see, where am I?
Go ahead.
The material science facilities have improved tremendously over the last 15 years, especially. Our capability for characterizing the structure and properties and compositions of materials has improved greatly with the laboratory facilities and equipment which we now have, which to a major extent have been brought in through departmental research by the material science staff. That this is an accomplishment that's worthy of note for those faculty. This has been paralleled by a substantial decline in the metallurgical laboratories for manufacturing process metallurgy, unfortunately. The metal casting lab, being somewhat of a dirty lab, is probably viewed as an anachronism by some faculty in the department, but it is one of the few laboratories in the United States which is equipped to carry on the scope of casting work which we do. I have concerns that that will continue, because when Professor Loper retires, we will lose the remaining expertise that we have in that field. So I'm hoping that we can replace him with an equivalent, a person of equivalent caliber.
Okay, can you discuss the major changes you've observed or directed in the structure and direction of the Department of Material Science and Engineering?
Well, I think that I have touched on that already. The emphasis has been on material science. In that connection, why we have moved into the area of ceramics, superconductivity, thermodynamics, a few other areas that don't come on my mind right now. But and these are all good changes, but they have not really benefited our manufacturing, engineering, metallurgy program directly.
So the material science is taking over in a sense?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And Morton Withey was dean when you were hired onto the faculty here. Could you discuss Dean Withey for a moment?
I don't feel capable of discussing Dean Withey. He was a real gentleman, a kindly man, and I can't really discuss Dean Withey, because at that time I was too inexperienced to evaluate what was going on.
Okay. Do you have any sense of any of his accomplishments or?
No.
Okay.
I wouldn't comment on that. And I don't care to discuss Deans Kurt Wendt, Robert Marshall, or John Bollinger.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay.
We're going to touch on your private energy consulting, and then we'll head into retirement, and we'll have your last words. You've served as a technical consultant to numerous private companies, like General Motors, Texas Foundries Incorporated, American Brake Shoe Company, and Greedy.
Greedy
Incorporated. Could you give me examples of some of the issues you consulted these companies about?
Well, in almost all cases, my work has been involved with trying to solve problems that were evident in their processes that needed to be corrected in order to avoid defective components. That's really been an area of my specialty in the casting process, to upgrade the quality of castings so that their properties and functions will be better than they have been. That's without exception. My present consulting activities are with American Standard Incorporated in the area of porcelain enameling of steel and cast irons, Greedy, Nina Foundry, Pelt and Cast Steel, Victaulic Company of America. Again, I'm usually asked to come in and evaluate the processes that they're carrying on, areas where they are having problems, that the processes are not functioning as well as they would like them to function, where new processes are being considered, and so forth and so on, all having to do with the overall success rate of what's coming out of their system.
And
problem solving, in other words, is what has been my main consulting work. And that's great because it's fun. It's just like detective work.
Okay, so you touched on the general nature of consulting. Can you comment on how it plays into your larger role as an academic researcher?
Well, when you go out into the industry, you encounter problems that are brought to your attention that you would never discover in a university laboratory. And that's how it impacts. A number of my research ideas have come forth from
your contacts with private industry.
Right.
So it's sort of a reciprocal relationship then.
Yeah.
Okay.
To me, if you're a successful professor in the technical or science field, it's almost inevitable that you will be approached to do some consulting work by people that have a need for answers.
Okay. Now I just want to briefly discuss your retirement. When and why did you decide to retire?
When and why?
Yeah.
I decided to retire in 1984 at the age of 66 because I could see that there were a number of things that I wanted to do, technically speaking, that I would never have time for if I continued to teach.
Okay.
Okay. Too much extraneous activity.
And have you worked for the College of Engineering and or consulted since your retirement?
Well, at the present time, I'm on the payroll to a minor extent in connection with this recycling project that I've been involved in. Other than that, I have not done so.
No consulting?
No. Well, I'm around here, you know. All kinds of people call up
with
questions.
Yeah, I've noticed that.
Because I have a relatively broad background in the past of the department and also in manufacturing field, the secretaries channel these calls to me.
Oh, okay.
Frequently, you know, unless they know someone else that has and expertise. I don't, most of the time, I'm not the one they want to talk to, but I can direct them to the other faculty member that they should be talking to.
Okay.
So I do have a useful activity here.
And you just mentioned a second that you still have a research project in recovery and recycling of molding sands.
Yeah.
You've already sort of discussed the nature of this, but what are the goals you envision for it?
Well, the goals are a function of the nature. The nature of the project is to disassemble a synthetic sand into its ingredients and improve their quality so that they can be used again.
Okay.
That's strictly a recycling deal, see?
Okay. Is that all you want to say about that?
Well, this is a recycling field that has been going on at an accelerated pace since actually all of the time that I've been associated with the industry, but the accelerated pace has come about since about 1970, and especially within the last 10 years.
Okay.
For two reasons. One is environmental, and the other one is economic.
And if you've been involved in any other work since retirement, or would like to discuss what has occupied your leisure time both before and after, please feel free to discuss any such activities.
Well, I do comment that I'm enjoying my retirement, enjoying the continuing pace of my technical activities, I'm enjoying my family, I'm enjoying my leisure time, which up until now has been involved in exercise and sports. I've had a long career as a handball player, which I have enjoyed. Played a lot of badminton too, all of which is fun. But at the age I'm at now, I'm departing from those activities and going more into walking. I think I said what I was saying was that I've enjoyed my retirement, and my principal physical activity at the present time is walking daily. And I especially enjoy walking along the shores of Lake Mendota from the Union over to Picnic Point.
The Howard Temin Path.
Yeah. Great way to walk.
Okay. And this is a section we call Last Words. Would you feel comfortable offering a forecast in the future of metal casting industry?
Well, the industry will continue. It will continue to improve. It will be of greater service. As I have said before, you can't have an economy without having a castings industry. You cannot have an economy without manufacturing. Computers won't substitute for it. This is a materials-based civilization that we live in. And if we want to enjoy the benefits of that kind of civilization, we will have to continue to make castings. There will no doubt be radical changes. I'm not going to predict those, but many of the processes that now exist will continue to exist and be practiced, and will be done with greater technological skill and better results. My only closing comments are that I've enjoyed my career tremendously. The most rewarding thing about what I've done in the past has been working with the students and seeing their development after leaving the classroom, and continuing relationships with them, especially when I am able to generate a close relationship, either through friendship or through consulting activities that continue the relationships that we started in the classroom.
Do you have any feelings about the University of Wisconsin in general? Any closing comments about the university?
Well, only that the litigious society, I believe, has downgraded the quality of relationships that occur.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Professor Heine.
My pleasure.
Professor Heine had one additional point he wanted to make about the history of castings.
In America. Yeah. Sir Walter Raleigh and some of his financial investors sent an investigative party to the New World. They went into North Carolina and discovered that there was iron ore there. So that was in 1584. In 1622, they sent another party over to establish an ironworks in Falling Creek, Virginia. They got as far as building a blast. Excuse me. As building a blast furnace and running off one heat when they were massacred by the Indians, who were suspicious of what they were doing. This is all historical in the record. But the first casting made in the New World was, our New World, was at the Saugus Ironworks in Saugus, Massachusetts, and it was a cast iron pot. And the big need at the time for the colonists was utensils to do their cooking in. So that's what they started to make. This is now a national park, by the way. Saugus, at Saugus, Massachusetts, with the ironworks. That happened in 1642. 1742, the Franklin stove was invented, which was a big step forward in more comfortable living and being made in the New World. In 1750, the English Parliament passed the Iron Act of 1750. Why did they pass it? Well, because of the fact that blast furnaces and castings were being established in the eastern part of our colonies, because of the fact that iron ore was abundant and charcoal was abundant because there were lots of trees around. And so locally, the iron workers, the knowledgeable people, the technologists of the age, made the charcoal and built up crude blast furnaces that would convert the iron ore to what we would call pig iron, molten iron.
Why do they call it pig iron?
Well, because it was cast out in a long runner with little blobs off to the side, like a sow feeding her piglets.
Oh, okay.
That's why it was called pig iron. Anyway, this Iron Act of 1750 would prevent, or was passed to prevent, the import of cast iron utensils, you know, cooking pots and frying pans and all that kind of stuff, into England. They were in a recession, which was caused by the fact that the English had used up their main source of fuel, charcoal fuel. They cut down all the trees, in other words. Environmental problems, just like we have today.
Mainly in Scotland, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, this was meant that exchange from England was going to the United States instead of coming the other way, where they had been selling their utensils over here. The export-import problem. So they passed this Iron Act of 1750, and what it did was it prevented the import of castings from the colonies, but allowed the import of pig iron so that the pig iron could be exported to England. They could melt it down and make castings and sell the castings back to the colonies. Of course, there was a tax on that, which had to be paid by the colonists. So that was a major economic problem as far as the industries of that time. And that led to the Declaration of Independence because of the fact that there were 13 foundrymen who were of the 36 signers of the Declaration of Independence.
Huh, I didn't know that.
Well, now you know.
Wow.
Anyway, so the foundry industry that existed at that time was the sole source of war material for the colonists until France entered the war in 1778. Okay. They then began to supply us with material that we didn't have or couldn't make here. So the French were good allies in that respect. So anyway, the war ended and the industry grew and so forth and so on. And concludes that particular historic perspective. I have more information from then on, but I won't go into that.
Okay.
How the foundry industry grew and so forth and so on.
Okay, again, thank you very much.
Sure.